You're listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety, where you'll hear conversations and insights from public safety professionals and those who train and support them. To learn more about CMPS training programs, visit mindfulpublicsafety.org.
Welcome to another session here on day 6 of the Global First Responder Resilience Summit. And I'm your host, Fleet Mall, and I'm very excited to be here today with Director Colette Peters from the Oregon Department of Corrections. Hello, Director Peters.
Hello. Great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you again. It's been a while since I've been able to get out to Oregon with the pandemic preventing travel. So I want to share with the audience a little bit about your background, and then we'll just jump right into the conversation. Our focus is today on leading healthy change in public safety, and I think people will get from your bio why you're an ideal presenter to be having this conversation with. So Colette Peters has served as director of the Oregon Department of Corrections since February 2012. She has the ultimate oversight for an agency with 4,700 employees, a biennial budget of $2 billion, and responsibility for managing 14,700 incarcerated adults in 14 prisons across the state. Ms. Peters played a crucial role in Oregon's justice reinvestment effort, which reduced the prison population and avoided opening additional institutions. Under Ms. Peters' leadership, Oregon Department of Corrections enrolled in the AMEND at University of California, San Francisco, and developed the Oregon Way. The goal is to improve employee health and wellness and reduce the use of segregation by transforming environments inside correctional facilities to be more normal and humane. The program has focused efforts on helping the adults in custody positively change their lives and become better neighbors. Ms. Peters holds a master's degree in criminal justice from the University of Colorado in Denver and a bachelor's degree in psychology from the College of St. Benedict and St. Joseph, Minnesota. And prior to being director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, I believe you were director of the Oregon Department of Youth Services.
The Oregon Youth Authority. That's right.
Authority, right. Yeah. So you've held Oregon state leadership positions in juvenile justice and adult corrections. Could you share a little bit about what drew you into public safety to begin with? How did you end up with this long career in public safety?
You know, I always knew I wanted to be in a helping fields. Didn't know exactly where it would take me in the very end, but I remember memories, Fleet, as early as kindergarten, where there was a young fellow classmate who had brought a pocket knife to school. I clearly remember the teacher putting him under her arm and marching him to the principal's office. And I remember thinking, oh, I need to help him. And I did. I followed him throughout his life. He weaved in and out of the juvenile justice system. And then it was really, I think, the whole of my education system really highlighted in Benedictine principles, from my early K through 6 experience to my college experience at an all Benedictine college, that really helped me understand that important link between public safety and that moral and social responsibility that we have for each other. And so I really took my Catholic liberal arts education into a career with public safety over the years, and just know how intimately connected those social services and public safety systems are. And I simply believe in people. I believe people can change. I believe that people are inherently good, and that often it's just the skills and the tools that are lacking. And so, you know, weaved my way through the criminal justice system, working as a victims advocate, as you mentioned, the Department of Corrections, the Youth Authority, and now I've been here. This is my 10th year as director of the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Wow. Well, we have a little commonality in our background. I had a good Jesuit education, so I'm very familiar with that. And I have family members that went to Benedictine schools. So as a director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, you have championed what you're calling the Oregon Way. Could you tell us what a little bit more what that's all about? And I think you've also, I don't know if they're related, but I know that you You've made some, I think you've had some of your personnel visit Norway. You've had some folks come over from Norway because a lot of people are familiar with the kind of Norway model of corrections, which is considered a somewhat enlightened approach in Scandinavia. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the core of our work has been employee wellness. So I think I'll start there, Fleet, which you have been intimately a part of here in Oregon, and really want to give accolades to your work and what it did to really catapult this wellness conversation in Oregon. So we'll be forever grateful for your work, your ongoing work here in Oregon. When I became director 10 years ago, we had 6 staff suicides in an 18-month period, and it was devastating for all of us, and we didn't understand it. I, as a former researcher, of course, turned to research to figure out what was happening in a correction setting, and there was nothing. We had studied firefighters, police officers, military, but we had not studied corrections, and so we brought in Portland State University and Oregon Health Sciences University to really help us understand what was happening with our employees. And what we learned was absolutely devastating. 1 in 3 of our employees had symptoms of PTSD, which you know leads to alcohol and drug abuse, divorces, dying young, all of those horrible statistics. And then we learned we physically weren't fit either. Over 90% were obese or overweight, over 90% had hypertension or pre-hypertension. And so we knew we had a significant issue to manage to. And so those two universities, along with your help around mindfulness meditation and teaching our people how to get from that state of hypervigilance up here to that state of vigilance, and how all of those brain traumas can come down in that moment. They actually become more effective corrections professionals. But putting those types of plans together to really help our employees become well, both for them and for those who they care for. The whole idea is if they're well, then their ability to care for these adults in custody just kind of snowballs in a really positive way. And then we've always had a progressive system here in Oregon. Long before I arrived, we had the Oregon Accountability Model, which really relied on research and data to drive our corrections practices. But it was also a very humane approach. It really was based in that interaction between our employees and those in our care and custody. So we always, you know, as I joined Oregon in 2004, you would walk the halls of our prisons and it didn't look like the movies. There were employees engaging with those in custody and really caring about their outcomes. And then we stumbled upon Norway. We had the ability through what is now the Amend program to visit Norway, and as you said, a very progressive system, well-renowned around the globe, and really embedded in that those two concepts of humanization and normalization. And we originally took a group of kind of high brass at DOC and a legislative group to study it and kind of get a first blush of what how they did corrections. And it was eye-opening. You know, as we sit in Oregon, I'm always kind of proud of the Oregon system, one of the best in the country. What does Norway have to offer that Oregon didn't? So went there a little bit skeptical. And it was a paradigm shift. I mean, absolutely. We talked about hypervigilance. You know, our employees in Oregon came to work every day in the forefront of their minds, knowing that they could get assaulted. The Norwegians came to work every day knowing that the likelihood of them getting assaulted was very low, but if it happened, they were prepared. And so they didn't enter the institutions with their brain elevated. And when bad things happened, they were trained and ready to deal with those circumstances. So it was really compelling. While we were there, you know, one of the things we thought of, Fleet, is how will we actually share what we've seen with our employees? And wouldn't it be amazing if we could do an exchange program? And somehow the Amend program figured out how to garner funding to get a group of officers, corrections professionals over to Norway. It was an exchange program. They moved in with employees of their same rank, got to learn their family, their culture, and work their shifts. And those individuals are really the ones credited with creating what you referred to as now the Oregon Way, that took who we were as a department with the Oregon Accountability Model, weaving in all of the things we had learned about employee wellness or lack thereof, and then adding these two principles of normalization and humanization to create what we're now calling the Oregon Way. And almost without exception, any changes that happened in the midst of kind of swirling those three things together were grassroots. It was employees on the ground that were thinking about creative, innovative ways to improve the environment, both for our employees and our adults in custody. It's been really great to see.
Wow. There's so much in what you shared in there. And what one thing that really struck me was you said in Norway, the staff and the officers are trained to have kind of a reasonable risk assessment. They actually feel that the likelihood of being attacked is not, it could happen, and they're prepared for it if it does happen. That's very different than, I think, culturally in the U.S., we've taken a very fear-based approach to training, like and instilling in everyone, it could happen at any moment. You have to be in constant danger and constant fear, which means you're in that hypervigilance all the time. And actually, that's not the best place from which to respond to a crisis, right? A few notches down in a state of readiness, you're actually going to respond better to an incident than if you're in that really red line type of hypervigilance all the time. So it really is a different approach.
It really is. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that concept alone gets embedded early on with our training. Mm-hmm. The way the Norwegians kind of explained it is we on a scale of vigilance or reactivity on a scale of 0 to 10, we're training at 10. What will the law allow us to do, right? Mm-hmm. That takedown, that interaction, we train to 10, 10, 10, 10. Mm-hmm. They train to 10 too, but they train to 0, and then 0, and then 1, and then back to 0, and then 2, and then back to 0. And just really understanding that it's this side of the spectrum, that 0, 1, 2, where you're changing behavior in a meaningful way, as opposed to just stopping behavior now. And so when you talk about the brain, Fleet, one of the things that I'm really excited about is Oregon Health Science University has recognized that when, as others have, when you're in that state of hypervigilance, as you said, you can't respond in your best way. You can't bring your best self. And it has long-term impacts on your organic brain. And so OHSU is now actually in partnership with us conducting brain scans of our employees. And about 400 employees have volunteered to do this to really understand what will the MRI reveal as it relates to our brain structure after a lifetime or a partial lifetime working in this field. So we look forward to seeing what that data reveals as well.
And not to be naive about prison environment, there certainly are risks, and there can be violence, and there can be you're in charge of locking up some people who at least at this point in their lives can be dangerous. And I don't know what the research said, but I would think that a more regulated staff, a staff with good regulation skills, is probably going to help create an environment where there will be less violence in the end. I'm wondering about your thoughts with that.
Absolutely the truth. We had two corrections professionals while we were in Norway talk about wanting to come back and work with one of our adults in custody by the name of we'll call him Mr. G. And when they mentioned his name, I knew exactly who they were talking about, even though we had almost 15,000 adults in custody at the time. And I knew because he was so severely mentally ill. He had assaulted our employees numerous times, countless times. He engaged in yelling and screaming all day long, riling up that whole unit. And when they said that they wanted to come back and work with him, I was nervous, Fleet. I thought, oh boy, if this works, great, but this is one of our toughest nuts to crack. If this does not work, we could throw the baby out with the bathwater. And sure enough, it was the notions that you just mentioned, Fleet, where they came and instead of trying to end the behavior that they were seeing right now, really develop that relationship and have meaningful interactions with this individual that has now led to a human being that has had some setbacks, no doubt. But previously, he was someone who wouldn't leave his cell. And now we've learned he's an artist. He has drawn me beautiful pictures. He is a musician. We were able to ultimately get him access to a guitar and really find who he was in a meaningful way. He's still in one of our mental health units, but doing incredibly well. And that's just one example of numerous stories that have occurred because of our setting of Norway and creating the Oregon Way.
Well, that's a great story, and it's just so important. The Oregon Way seems that it's essentially about humanization, right? And recognizing the humanity in each other, whether you're staff, whether you're incarcerated, that if we can all recognize each other's basic humanity, we're going to get better results.
That's right.
Yeah. So I remember the first conversation I had with you and your leadership team and talking about bringing in a mindfulness-based wellness and resiliency program. And I brought up that what we're going to be talking about here is not just a program, but it's really culture change. And so you've been in a long-term process of culture change around bringing in wellness skills, around this idea of the Oregon Way and so forth. And, you know, working with an agency the size of the Oregon Department of Corrections, 4,700 employees, can probably be a bit like trying to change course on an aircraft carrier. And I'm just curious about what your journey has been like in terms of managing culture change and sustaining culture change over time.
You know, COVID has given us a whole new gift of challenges to manage too, especially as it relates to employee wellness. And so It's forever changing is my point in bringing that up. If ever there was a need for wellness and caring for these employees, it's these first responders who have come to work every day battling all of the things that they normally battle, plus a pandemic, plus other things that the year has sent us our way, wildfires, evacuations, flooding. Mm-hmm. It's just been a nonstop pouring of things for these folks to manage. But truly the success, as you pose your question, Fleet, the thing that comes to mind are the employees themselves. It really was key individuals who understood that we needed to make change, had the capital amongst employees to kind of share their story. And one of them was a sergeant of ours. He was the union president at the time, who he himself had his own internal battles with being a corrections professional. And it was really impacting his life personally. There was a divorce pending, there was alcoholism, and he considered suicide, but not for his son, who arrived on scene. That is likely where his life would have ended. And as union president, he was willing to tell his story and really talk about the evolution that needed to happen. And by that, I mean, for years, much like the rest of our public safety partners, corrections professionals didn't talk about the impact of the job. We are tough as nails. We've got this. We're fine. We, you know, are part of some horrific incidents where it, following a suicide or an assault, and we say, nope, I'm going back to my shift. I'm good. I'm fine. And we don't deal with the trauma. We don't face the trauma. We don't work through the trauma. And he worked through the trauma, and he was willing to share with our employees what it means to work through the trauma and not put it on a shelf and have it build up and fester where it comes out with PTSD and an inability to deal with the next incident in a really healthy way. And it's him and people like him that really allowed us to begin to change the environment, where now it's very normal for our employees to walk up to each other and say, Fleet, you know, you're just not yourself. You're just not who you were a couple of weeks ago. What's going on? What's happening? Or very common, to the point of mindfulness, for our employees to walk up to each other following incident and say, let's go walk and breathe. Let's go shut the door and meditate for a little bit and see if we can bring down that adrenaline and kind of get our biomarkers back where they need to be. And so, of course, we have a long ways to go. It will always be evolving and ever changing, but it certainly has been a move in the right direction for these professionals that just do amazing work.
Well, I remember a number of years back being shown the video interview with the president of the union, that sergeant, and it was incredibly compelling. And I heard, I don't know how this accurate this is, but I heard at the time that when it was shown to staff widely, there were many who welcomed finally somebody's breaking the silence, and there was really welcome opening up that conversation. And then there were still some that felt like, oh, he crossed the line. Right. And so that was maybe kind of where the culture was at that time. And it sounds like it's probably shifted since then.
I think it's certainly shifted. I think that he, you know, had the 3 decades of experience. People really respected him. Mm-hmm. I think the video was shocking for sure, as you said. And so mm-hmm. kind of put people back on their heels. But then really just continuing and furthering the conversation has really loosened up that ability to talk in a real way about the impacts of working in a field like correction.
That's great. And you know, as a leader, and the leader of your very large agency, I'm curious about, you know, you talked about the employees who become the champions for change, and you talked about him as one example. I know there are many others. And you talked about the staff that went over to Norway on the exchange program, and they came back and they've been champions for culture change and wellness and so forth and different approaches. So, but as a leader, you know, could you say something about your job and how you sort of identify these champions and support these champions and help, you know, kind of keep that momentum for change moving forward? Even in the face of, and you know, I can only imagine, I think you had a lot of traction going, and then, you know, the pandemic hit, and it almost seems like, you know, starting all over in a sense. But could you talk about your role as a leader and, you know, for other leaders and how you work with identifying those champions and supporting them in this process to create the momentum for this kind of positive cultural change?
Yeah, I think, you know, they always say it's so wonderful when you have the right people in the right seats during a trying time. And I am so grateful for the people, my deputy director, the individuals who are part of my executive team right now, and the individuals that are part of our leadership team. They're just absolutely positively in the right roles in the midst of all the world has sent our way. And it's really just leaning into them and relying on them and their relationships and understanding what the pulse of our institutions are, who the employees are that might be the perfect naysayers to have around the table, might be the perfect, you know, supporters around the table. And I think that's one of the things that helped us the most, is that we didn't bring yes people around the table to explore Norway and explore the Oregon Way. We brought people who were incredibly skeptical. And then people who were incredibly educated on the program and couldn't wait to learn more, and people all the way in between, to really make sure that the conversations we were having were real. Because I anytime a grand idea comes from central office as this new shiny object that everyone needs to pay attention to, that's not lasting cultural change. That's a nice shiny object. If you are having a real conversation, having all ranks and all different parts of the organization around the table, exploring the ideas and asking questions and questioning in theory and in operational capacity, that's when I've seen long-lasting, fulfilling cultural change and modifications to an environment. Like you said earlier, could feel a little bit like moving the Titanic, but when it's the frontline folks making the momentum, it moves a lot faster.
Wow. I think that's a key leadership skill, bringing in, really including the skeptics and even the naysayers or the potential naysayers in the process. I think that's such a critical leadership strategy. Now, I remember also, in terms of the mindfulness aspect of wellness and some of the mindfulness-based wellness skills, we were able to do a weekend intensive retreat with a lot of your top leadership. And for them to actually have a deep experience, you know, spending a whole weekend, you know, practicing walking and sitting mindfulness all day long and in silence. And that was like way off their radar screen for many of them. Some of them had a little experience, some of them no previous experience. But to see these leaders, I think the assistant director, the operational director for your system was there, and other lieutenants and captains and majors and so forth. And to see them have that experience, you just knew something good was going to come out of that.
But no doubt about it. And the experience that you provided to our team, without exception, was life-changing. And I heard people out of that retreat say that again and again, life-changing retreat. And again, you know this because you were there, that room was filled with skeptics, naysayers, mm-hmm. and then people who had practiced mindfulness meditation and everything in between. And you moved everyone. I don't think there was a soul there that didn't understand the positive impacts of mindfulness meditation at the end of that weekend, both for them and many of them brought partners or spouses. Mm-hmm. And so the impact really went not just to that group, but to the people that report to them and to their families. And I think that's one of the most compelling things that we've seen out of our wellness work, out of our Oregon Way work, out of the mindfulness meditation, is the impact that we've had on corrections professionals' families. The news that I get from spouses or children about how their parent has now changed, is coming home happier. I had a sergeant who engaged in the Norway program as well as mindfulness meditation, and his wife was pretty convinced he was having an affair because he was coming home happy now. That was not the case. It was just a life-altering experience for him to be able to really kind of capture what's really going on at work in a healthy way, so that you can come home healthy and be present with your family and your children. That's very powerful for me.
Absolutely. That's one of the most gratifying aspects of my work, because I hear it again and again from people in mm-hmm. our trainings who come back for a second training or something. They talk about how their relationship with their spouses and kids has completely shifted in really positive ways. In many cases, yeah. they've reestablished relationships with their spouses and their children. And that when I hear that, that just makes it all worthwhile. Let's talk a little bit about your leadership at the national level. So I know you've been chairing the, I think it's the Health and Wellness Committee at the American Correctional Association. I know you've been on a national commission having to do with the pandemic and corrections. You have a leadership role in a number of national organizations and a lot of focus nationally on wellness. So could you talk a little bit about what's happening nationally and the importance of leadership, both the policymakers and the operational leaders, to shift the culture and to get some traction nationally, especially in the face of what we're dealing with today?
Yeah, sure. So when we began our wellness work, that not only was a value for the Oregon Department of Corrections, but it was also a value for OHSU and PSU, that if we finally figured out how to make change in this area for corrections employees, that we would be able to share it with the nation. As you have done with your work, spreading mindfulness meditation across the country in prisons and jails throughout. And so with the National Institute of Corrections, I'm currently chair of that advisory board. But when we were beginning these conversations around wellness, I chaired the subcommittee on wellness. And since that time, the National Institute of Corrections has made employee wellness a top priority, as has the American Correctional Association. You're right, I do get the privilege of chairing their Healthy Culture Committee, Employee Wellness Committee, and they really have done exceptional work. It's a very active committee. Those committee members are just filled with ideas and constantly producing action items that are making change across the country. And that includes education, research, publications, and employee wellness at the national conferences. We were able to host, I believe, our fourth Employee Wellness Expo, where when people come together, thousands and thousands of people come together for the American Correctional Association Conference, they're actually able to enter a wellness expo where they can learn about the negative impacts of working in this field and then the tools to get you through it. Plus, it includes an opportunity to meditate in that expo, receive a massage, meet with a nurse to take your vitals and talk about what you need to do in order to improve your physical well-being as well. And, you know, I think that's really important. Many of our corrections professionals we found didn't have their own personal data. So they have these great health insurance benefits, but their life is so stressful. There's not time to get to a general practitioner. So when we do get them access, they learn that they are in the obese category. And while they knew that they needed to shave off some weight, they didn't realize they fit into that dangerous category. While they knew they should, you know, maybe dial down the number of drinks they had a week, they had no idea it was catapulting them into a place of hypertension or pre-hypertension. So really using that national influence to make that change across the country, I hope really drives corrections professionals to a whole new level from a wellness perspective and, of course, for outcomes for the adults in custody.
Well, just the fact that these national organizations like the American Correctional Association, National Institute of Corrections, and others are prioritizing wellness and employee safety and so forth, really speaks to some kind of change. But I'm curious, you interact with a lot of correctional leaders across the country, and I'm curious if you are really seeing the pendulum shift, if you're seeing a kind of a national commitment to employee safety and wellness.
I am, no doubt about it. I think you can't listen to the sergeant you listen to or listen to the data without being compelled to go back and do something for your people, right? And so I think that's certainly what we saw from these directors across the country. You know, like me, they had attended the funerals. They had talked people through the divorces. They had seen people lose their careers because of DUIs. But we hadn't really addressed the issue. And so to be able to provide tools for these directors to go back and do things, one, they simply just wanted to do it. But then secondly, associations like the American Correctional Association created standards where if you're going to be ACA accredited, you will have a wellness program. That makes change. You measure what matters, people to pay attention to what gets measured, right? Mm-hmm. And so being able to even do simple things like that really, I think, have made a difference. And then you mentioned the COVID Commission, the Council on Criminal Justice, a relatively new think tank filled with really great individuals around the board of trustees and the council at large. Even when they're looking at topic issues like policing right now or COVID inside our institutions, even that was done with a lens through employee wellness. And so I think that certainly is a sign of the times and a sign that the nation is really beginning to value our corrections professionals and really understand the importance of keeping them well.
So having a career like you have, having the level of responsibility that you have, I assume you have found interesting ways to work with this, and especially during the pandemic now, having that oversight and that responsibility for 4,700 employees and 14,700 incarcerated adults. What do you do to take care of yourself? How do you stay resilient as a leader and as a human being?
Well, I like to say it's hard to be human, so some days are better than others. I always did pride myself in being healthy. I'm a runner. I drink lots of water. My husband and I are very serious about what food comes into the house, what we eat. But even when I began our work with OHSU and, you know, the doctors were showing us what's important, I checked those boxes. And then he started talking about sleep. And before I met Dr. Carrie Keel, I would probably work until midnight, and then I'd get up at 4:30 and get my workout in because that's what we were supposed to do, and then proceed to work all day again until we got dinner on, worked with the kids, and when the kids got to bed, then I'd pull that iPad out and work until midnight again. And Dr. Carrie Keel made it very clear that I might as well be getting up and smoking a pack of cigarettes. That sleep component was so important. And of course, it's the REM sleep that we've all heard about, but it's really that deep sleep that allows you to fight cancer, to fight heart disease. And so I then began placing a really significant importance on sleep and measuring it and watching it. I've got my Apple Watch that tells me what my sleep was like the night before, and really paying attention to that. And that really has made a difference. And really talking and trying to be my true self around my executive team, not pretending that everything is fine, but really talking mm-hmm. about what are the stressors at home? What are the stressors around the conference table? What are the stressors coming in from the governor's office or the legislative process? And then giving them that permission to really be real about what's going on with them as well, so that we can support each other and really, really accept kind of that this is just a really difficult field and we've got significant challenges. And then doing the same at home, just being really real with my husband and the kids about what's happening at work and kind of the stressors that come along with that, so that we're all being really honest about what life is like and how we're going to get through those challenges. But certainly the running, the eating well, drinking lots of water, yoga, meditation, all of those things certainly help keep me centered. But again, hard to be human, so I'm not centered all the time, but always working towards it.
Well, you spoke very eloquently, but I think I often think of resilience as having a vertical axis or pole, which is all things we can do to take care of ourselves, even, you know, the depth of our spiritual well-being that we access through faith or meditation or so forth, but all the things we can do to be more resilient as individuals. But then that critical horizontal landscape of our social connections and being willing to be open and vulnerable and transparent with others, you know, just it just changes everything. It's the isolation that can really... And, you know, tough jobs often can tend to be isolating. And then with the pandemic, there's a push towards isolation, right? So it seems like it's really time to double down on maintaining our connections and really healthy connectedness personally and professionally.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. If ever there was a time that we needed to double down personally and then as an agency and an organization on wellness and care for each other, it's now.
Well, I'd like to kind of finish off here by, and this has been wonderful, and thank you so much, asking you to pull out your crystal ball a little bit, maybe. And, you know, it doesn't look like the world's going to get any less complex or any easier anytime soon. Unfortunately, we're hearing that, you know, this pandemic may have become endemic, and this may be something that cycles back year after year. There may be other pandemics coming our way. We have the climate crisis, which can create is already creating all kinds of disruptions. You had the fires out there in Oregon, and we've just seen incredible flooding in the Northeast from Hurricane Ida. And, you know, I mean, it's just clear that, and, you know, with population and the stresses that's going to be globally and how interconnected our world is globally. I mean, you know, there's just no way to isolate in a bubble somewhere and be okay. And so things are going to be really challenging. And I often think, you know, some of these disruptions could even lead to social chaos in some places if we don't have a resilient communities, cohesive communities, and resilient individuals and leaders, and especially our public safety system. You know, if our public safety system is challenged more by social instability, political instability, and it's not resilient, that's not a good combination. So I'm just curious about, you know, what you see as the future of public safety, and how, you know, that maybe leaders need to be thinking about preparing the field for an even more challenging profession in the coming decades.
Yeah, you say that you think you can predict what's coming, but anyone who says that now after the last year that we have is not telling the truth, because there is no way we could have predicted all of the things that you just mentioned, Fleet, including the flooding. The fires required us to evacuate 7 prisons, even in the midst of our most significant incident command training. We wouldn't have put evacuations of 7 prisons on a tabletop exercise, right? Mm-hmm. And so the challenges are not going away, it seems. Now, what I hope continues to happen is that we continue to drive down the population in corrections. We have engaged in mass incarceration in Oregon and across this country, period, end of story. There's no close second in the industrial world. And so the pandemic has allowed us to drive some of those numbers down, be it courts delayed or law enforcement officers dealing with more serious things on the street, DAs not prosecuting except the most serious, most violent. and public safety reform. You mentioned justice reinvestment. That has now impacted nearly every single one of our states and has allowed us to drive our population down. In Oregon alone, we have 3,000 fewer adults in custody today than we did before the pandemic. And a substantial proportionate impact at the women's prison, where that population has went from about 1,280 down to just over 800. So almost a 35% reduction. I hope that's a good start. I hope that's not the end, because we know what happens to generations of parents who are incarcerated, what happens to their children. And we need to break down the focus of who we are. We are the emergency room, if you will, for public safety. We're expected to handle everything. And by that, I mean, corrections has now become the largest mental health hospital in each state. We have become the largest alcohol and drug treatment provider in each state. That is not part of our mission. That is not what we were put in place to manage to. And so when I hear your question, in addition to all of the things I just mentioned, the most substantial evolution that needs to happen is our connectivity to our health authorities. Now, it happens in the midst of a pandemic, but all of the things that need to be improved in order to drive down the number of people incarcerated has to do with health and mental health, and getting the resources on the front end in the communities before these individuals create crime victims and get the help they need. And so we've built bridges now to our state health authorities and our local county public health authorities, but now we need highways and we need to build strong highways between those agencies to really make substantial change down the road. And that will change the lives of those in our care and custody and drive down the population, which in turn will create better work environments for our employees, and it will just all swirl together nicely. So I don't know if that's an accurate crystal ball, but that's certainly my wish list, Fleet.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I think you're pointing to one of the potentially the silver linings of this pandemic is, I mean, hopefully this pandemic has been a huge wake up call for all of us on so many levels, but it's just shown us our interconnectedness all over the world in such dramatic ways. But public health has become front and center. You know, how many of us were even aware of public health and the public health systems and the public health director and all this? And you know, a public health approach to human thriving is really, I think, what we're seeing is necessary. And we've kind of been in denial, social denial, for a long time, and not investing in the front end to support people to have good lives instead of putting the resources in the back end to maintain, you know, our mistakes or lack of resourcing people. And so hopefully there is a big shift here. I know even around violence, I have a longtime colleague in Chicago who really pioneered, you know, taking a public health approach to violence. He's an epidemiologist. He understands that violence it operates in the same way that viruses do. And you have to treat it as a public health issue to reduce the violence. So I think you're right on there. And hopefully the pandemic has really awakened us all to the need to really focus on investing in the front end of public health from birth forward for human beings and for our communities. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Director Peters. This has been great. And I know you're incredibly busy with a lot of responsibilities. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join our summit today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, always a pleasure to spend time with you, Fleet. So thank you so much. And thank you to all those that are out there listening.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety. Video of these podcasts are also available. You'll find access information in the description. And learn more about CMPS training programs at mindfulpublicsafety.org. See you next time.